It is ceremony and pomp, and let's not forget a great dollop of circumstance. But it's also a chance for the gathered peoples of this island to show what they think about the way they've been governed. But an overt showing of general sentiment is rare. Some examples. During the First World War, the then governor, Lord Raglan, was, it can be safely said, not the political pin-up for many. He was, by all accounts, a very social and sociable person, a must-have at soirees and dinners. But in political terms, he was, what's the phrase, not for turning. Nothing moved in terms of social legislation while he was in office, and he was in office for some years. The period wasn't fixed in those days, though, of course, our present governor has extended his tenure by a year, partly to enable him to take in our general election next year. When Lord Raglan left the Hill in 1916, he was, in a newspaper reporter's view, sodded. That doesn't mean to say a sod of earth was hurled or anything else. It was more likely to be in some grass, but even so, to throw anything at the, in Manx terms, highest in the land, for the governor in those days was de facto the president, was an indication that not all was well in the sentiment of the people. Here's how events on Tynwald Hill unfolded in that year. The situation on the Isle of Man in 1916 was tense. The war was still progressing very slowly, and the economic hardships on the island intensifying. Matters became even worse when the Military Service Act, conscription, was introduced on the Isle of Man. The war had resulted in the collapse of the tourist industry and mass employment. All calls for help from the Lieutenant Governor, Lord Raglan, were ignored, and the island had no social welfare benefits or poor relief. Things got so severe that an extraordinary protest took place on Tynwald Day, July 1916. An angry crowd of 2,000 men and women came to protest against Lord Raglan, who they claimed was a tyrant and a dictator. The crowds booed, jeered, and demanded reforms under the slogan, "Raglan must go." Placards and badges bearing the slogan were widely distributed. Lord Raglan, apparently unswayed by the hostile crowds, continued to walk amongst the rushes to Tynwald Hill. At this point, he was sodded by a clump of grass thrown from the crowd. This truly extraordinary incident was a measure of his deep unpopularity among ordinary people. The protesters sent a petition for Lord Raglan's immediate removal to the King of England. None of this had any impact on Lord Raglan's rule, nor did it soften his stance on social welfare. The leader of the protests and head of the War Rights Union, Samuel Norris, who was sent to jail, recalled the day in these words. "Tynwald Day on 1916 dawned in all the glory of a midsummer holiday, but in most other respects, July 5th, 1916, the Manx Day of Independence, was memorable for scenes and incidents which have probably had no parallel in the island's history. From each of the three platforms, large cards were displayed. We want a new governor. Taxation of wealth, no food taxes, revenue from the camps for war distress, redress, retrenchment and reform." On the other side of the coin was Tynwald Day during our COVID crisis. The then Chief Minister, Howard Quayle, who along with the Health Minister, David Ashford, had borne the brunt of the reporting to the public of the development of the disease, was cheered from Tynwald Hill. Mr. Quayle comes off the hill to a round of applause, takes his top hat off, doffs it to the crowd, says thank you, the last time we believe that he will be in this ceremony. Moves down the ceremony walkway, through the guard of honour, looking from side to side, taking it all in. Nods slightly to the crowd, thanking them for their applause. You can't really stop politics covering the ceremony like a great canopy over the hill. But what happens on the hill on this day is a fait accompli. The laws promulgated have already been argued over, some to enormous length. This ceremonial is the final act. But much of today is about history. Without the input of the Vikings, the chances are we wouldn't have this occasion. So let's take a moment or two to consider how and why these Witcher lookalikes happened to arrive here. Anno Domini, now Christian era, 793, ships carrying some of the finest sailors in the world arrived off the coast of Northumberland. The Norsemen, Northmen or Vikings, had left their homeland for, it seems, a number of reasons. Norway was apparently running out of agricultural land in the face of a growing population. It was a mountainous country with sandy soil, not good for farming. Only the eldest son inherited the family farm, so siblings had to look elsewhere. Vikings, like the Spartan people of Greece, put great value in physical prowess, in fighting ability. They may have come before, but the attack on the monastery at Lindisfarne was particularly vicious. A sudden assault from the sea, with the monks slaughtered, drowned or enslaved, and the church treasures seized. It took some time, but gradually word of the attack spread along the eastern seaboard of the British Isles. It had perhaps served its purpose to strike terrible fear into the hearts of all the inhabitants. 2 years later, Irish and Welsh annalists record the appearance of the Northmen in their dragon ships in the Irish Sea. Their hegemony of the Manx was about to begin. It may be the subject of a school children's concert these days, but back then the glimpse of sails on the horizon probably would have caused panic. There may have been some resistance, but in the main there would have been little to stop the invaders charging up the shingle beach. Their progress would have been inexorable, unstoppable. They were fighting men up against the villagers, fishermen. The Norsemen stretched their ambitions towards Europe and also to the west. The Isle of Man was in an ideal position to profit from trade between Ireland and the Scottish Islands. It was on the sailing route between Scandinavia and Ireland. And as today, it's a green and pleasant land, ideal for farming and settlement, very alluring to the new arrivals. And arrive is what the Vikings did, we believe, for the first time here in 798. The Norwegians were thought to come down the Western Isles, while the Danes came down the eastern coast of Britain. We still find in common use the Norwegian terms fell, garth and gill on the side of Britain. They soon found a small islet just off the west coast of Peel, ideal to develop as a fortified base. That became, of course, Peel Castle. As they consolidated control, they brought their system of Parliament, or tings. There were tings already elsewhere. The Tingvilla and the Logting in the Faroes. Ting means assembly, a gathering in which laws were made official. And ignorance of the laws wasn't an excuse. The people were expected to be at these assemblies and therefore be aware of any laws that might apply to them. Much is made of the reaction of those on the receiving end of this violent Viking expansion, but one would imagine it must have been quite an experience for those who had rowed round the north of Scotland, and some have tried to see what that was like. We'll hear from one later, one of the crew of the Odin's Raven that came from Norway. But what were these Vikings' initial impression of this island? I am in a somewhat smaller craft than the dragon ship. I am sitting in a kayak and I'm below the cliffs that run from Bradda Head through to Fleshic, around the corner from Port Erin. Today, it's blue skies and a breeze. The sea's a little choppy, and a bit of a swell crashing waves against the rocks. But
When these cliffs up above my head and they thump magnificent, are shrouded in mist, they look truly forbidding, truly scary. Those newly arrived wouldn't have known much about this place, apart from talks they'd heard. They didn't know who the inhabitants were they warlike? Was there a beach where they could draw their boats up? If the fog was down, they would have been groping their way carefully up this coast. The crew, we get the impressions they were all fearless. Well, one or two might have been those that were left a little option, but to leave home as there was no real place for them there. There was no land for them to farm. They had to go look for somewhere else. They may have been deeply apprehensive, scared even. Yes, scared probably. This is a mighty place. The cliffs are ponderous in their mass. The grasses come tumbling down their side. Presumably, they're much the same as they would have been then. There would have been as there are now. Seals! They're over there. There are guillemots. There's a group of them over there on the water. Basking sharks. I haven't seen any today. But probably they were around. Even whales, orcas, and lots of fish.
She has no house to lay her guest in, but one chill bed for all to rest in, that the pale suns and the stray birds nest in.
What was it like to sit in an open vessel for weeks, you know, sometimes violent sea? Well, a group of Manx and Norwegians know, because they came together for the Manx Millennium in 1979, sailing a two-thirds replica of the Godstad vessel from Norway to the island. Robin Bigland, the inspiration for the extraordinary voyage, was in the crew.
Everything we had to do was to be done in front of everybody else in the crew. Obviously, because there's no cover, it's a rowing boat. So in order to get over that problem, they told us that we should, in fact, train naked, because that got over any embarrassment that people might feel about, because you were concentrating on the training and getting the job done. And so, you know, I mean, the fact you were doing it naked was really irrelevant. I don't suppose that galley slaves bothered much about the fact that they were naked when they were changed, when they just got on with rowing. So, I mean, it was just a sensible thought, because, you know, you understand that all bodily functions and things have to be completed in front of other people. But if you don't make sure that, you know, you keep yourself okay in that respect, you'll get ill. So, I mean, and we were 31 nights at sea. So, I mean, you have to be sure that you train properly, and nobody better than the SBS to do that and train you.
So when you set off, did the romance fall away quite quickly and you sort of turned into mission mode, if you will, and started focusing on what you had to do?
You're damn right it fell away quickly, because we were, no sooner we got down the fjord from Trondheim to the open sea, where you got about 20 miles out, and the only vessel we saw really on the voyage practically, because we're very low in the water, you don't see very far, was a fishing boat that came across to us, offered us some fish, and told us that they had a couple of sister ships that were making haste to get back to a place called Ørlesund around Stad Point, and because there was a very large storm coming, and we were heading straight into it. So we didn't know that that was the case, albeit we'd taken a obviously, we tried to get some weather condition information. But, you know, I mean, things were not like they are today. You couldn't just use your whatever equipment, such as we have today. I mean, all we had was a compass, which is basically what the Vikings had, in effect. They had a lodestone that would point north. And anyway, we hurried into Ørlesund and rode out, were able to ride out the storm there. But it was a serious one. So, yes, I mean, we were pretty quickly disabused of any romantic visions of sailing into the, you know, sunset and all that kind of stuff. Yeah, great. Later, you know, things did get somewhat better. But we had a pretty wet voyage in many cases. And, you know, you are wet, and there's nothing you can do about it. You just have to get on with it.
Do you remember any moments where a sort of stillness came about the crew or yourself, and you could reflect on what you were doing? And
well, indeed, simply because during the night time, the reason we travelled at night a lot was in order to get very close to the next place where we were going to be met and greeted. And, you know, it had been arranged in principle, let's say, turn up at 10 o'clock or something in the morning. Well, you can't just travel a couple of hundred miles and then turn up at 10 o'clock kind of stuff. You have to get there first and then row around the headland or sail around the headland or something and be there, which is what we did. So our sailing would be done at night very much. But having said that, I mean, bear in mind that in those latitudes, you get what the Shetlanders call the simmer dim, which is twilight, really. So that was a big help. And yes, naturally, one had a chance to reflect and take in the beauty of our surroundings, certainly, when it wasn't raining.
Businessman Robin Bigland, one of the driving forces behind the momentous voyage of Odin's Raven in 1979, and he was on board the vessel as well. The vessel, landlocked now forever, can be seen at the House of Mananin in Peel. But let's go back further than that millennium year. Let's go back 80 years to 1945 and an historic Royal Tynwald.
History was made today, July the 5th, 1945. This morning, King George VI personally conducted the Tynwald ceremony at St. John's, the first King of England ever to preside over our ancient Parliament, both on the hill and in the church afterwards. Some spectators at St. John's took their positions around the foot of the hill as early as 5 this morning, and 3 hours before the ceremony was due to start, thousands were on the fairground. On arrival, the King took a salute from the Royal Naval Guard of Honour and carried out an inspection before laying a wreath at the War Memorial. The church service followed the accustomed form of a shortened matins and was taken by the Reverend Lamb, who is still serving in the RAF and had flown in from his station for the service. The procession for the walk to Tynwald Hill was formed as the congregation left the church. The sword-bearer was Lieutenant Colonel Kissack. When all were seated on the hill, the King directed Deemster Farrant to have the court fenced. The coroner for Glenfaber is J.J. Lewin.
Learned Deemster, direct the court to be fenced.
Coroner of Glenfaber, fence the court.
I fence this court in the name of our most gracious Sovereign Lord the King. I charge that no person do quarrel, brawl, or make any disturbance, and that all persons answer to their names when called. I charge this audience to witness this court is fenced. I charge this audience to witness this court is fenced. I charge this whole audience to bear witness. This court is now fenced.
There was a departure from the usual custom of the coroners handing in their rod of office. This year, all 6 proceeded together up the mound to hand them over to the King before reappointment and then being sworn in. The scene is described by David Southwood.
Now the outgoing coroners, having taken off their silk hats, walk up the steps to the top tier of Tynwald Hill to surrender their staves of office to His Majesty the King. This stave represents the old authority that in the days of yore, the coroners who had only 1 year in office had to surrender their staves at the end of that year. And then the new coroners were given the staves of office as a form of authority.
Incoming coroners, take the oath in ancient form to execute your office for the ensuing year and to receive your staves of office from the hands of His Majesty the King.
And the first Deemster, as you've just heard, has now called on the new coroners to receive their staves of office from His Majesty. And they're just going up to the top of the hill now and are receiving them and going back down again to the bottom.
By that book and by the holy contents thereof and by the wonderful works that God hath miraculously wrought in heaven above and in the earth beneath in 6 days and 7 nights, you shall, without respect of favour, of friendship, love, or gain, consanguinity, or affinity, envy, or malice, well and truly execute the respective officers of coroner of the sheeting of Den Faber, of the sheeting of Michael, of the sheeting of Eyre, of the sheeting of Garth, of the sheeting of Middle, and of the sheeting of Russian for the ensuing year. So help you God.
The king then instructed that the 15 acts which had received royal assent during the previous year be promulgated in English and in Manx. Deemster Farrant read the abstracts of the acts in English and the Reverend Canon in Manx.
Learned Deemster and Reverend Leather, I exhort you to proclaim to the people in ancient form such laws as have been enacted during the past year and which have received my assent.
Abstract of Acts of Tynwald. Number one, the Workmen's Compensation Temporary Increases Act 1944. The object and purpose of this act is to increase temporarily the supplementary allowances payable to workmen under the Workmen's Compensation Act 1919.
Irunen, in slapis aelia obrien, bishachin tamaltach, nihi jeg tier estaid, an agnia as a kush jane slatus shaw, the vudica rish tamalt, natuatin vudit, ikit de obrien, Pon slatus aelia obrien, nihi jeg, ni jeg.
Number two, the Port Erin Biological Station and...
Following the reading of the laws, the King held an investiture, at which 43 persons, including members of all three services, received honours and decorations. Following the investiture and the traditional three cheers for the King, the procession reformed and returned to the chapel, where a short sitting of Tynwald Court was held, presided over by His Majesty.
The Tynwald will adjourn to the chapel and complete such business as remains to be transacted. Mr. Speaker and gentlemen of the House of Keys, the first business and before us in the chapel is the captioning of the acts I just promulgated on Tynwald Hill. And I have given my assent to the following acts. Of the Pensions Increase Act 1945, of the House of Industry Act of 1945, and the Income Tax Amendment Act of 1945.
The King then addressed the Manx people.
Now, the Queen and I are deeply touched by the warmth of the welcome we have received. It gives us great pleasure to visit your beautiful island and to be among my loyal Manx people. Of the ancient and dignified order of the promulgation of laws on Tynwald Hill, which you have witnessed, a date from long before a written record, but has for centuries preserved its characteristic ritual from the time of the Norse kings to the present day. And never before has the King of England been present in person at this most interesting ceremony. And it is a particular satisfaction to me that the occasion is the first Tynwald Day following the end of the war in Europe. In bringing this gigantic conflict to a victorious conclusion, the people of this little island have played their part by land, by sea, and by air. Your homes have been spared the ravages of war. But, in common with all my peoples, you have had great anxieties. You are now faced with the task of rebuilding your prosperity. It is my heartfelt wish that under God's providence, you may enjoy of the blessings of peace. Your Excellency, my Lord Bishop, a gentleman of the Council, Mr. Speaker, a gentleman of the Keys, that concludes our business for today. Tynwald is adjourned till 11 o'clock on next Tuesday at its usual place of meeting. The council will now retire, and the keys will remain to transact such business as remains before them.
The Examiner reported the royal visit on its front page of July the 6th.
The visit of the King and Queen to the Isle of Man this week has been a big success and has given great joy to all Manx people and residents in the island. The weather has not been too well behaved. Mananan's royal mantle of sea mist, which upset arrangements from the outset and necessitated a sea journey for their majesties in place of the proposed trip by air, has persisted during their visit and deprived them of the opportunity to see much of the Manx countryside. Everywhere they have gone, their majesties have been met by enthusiastic crowds who have, in no uncertain manner, demonstrated the loyalty there is in the island for the royal sovereign.
Miss Jean Thornton-Dewsbury paraded in Ramsey with her girl guides.
I was out with the guides in Parliament Square, and rather to my horror, she signalled that she was coming to speak to us. So she did, and asked what company we were. And she smiled and looked so kindly at each girl. Each one thought she'd specially spoken to her, you know. It was very nice like that. And I had one little girl with me who was very undersized for her age. She'd been very delicate, very ill, and hadn't gone to school until she was about 10. And then she joined guides. And she'd been to camp, and she'd become a guide in camp. And she spoke to them all. Then she moved on down the line, and when I looked down, this little girl was looking up at me, and her face was absolutely transfigured. She was radiant, and she said, "Oh, Captain," used to call the guide as captains in those days, "Captain, I am glad I was enrolled as a guide before the Queen came," which I thought was rather nice.